Hi again, everybody. I'm Dan Hoard, and thanks for downloading the Bengals Booth Podcast. The What Do You Want Me to Do? Make all the big decisions for you. Addition, as my broadcast partner Dave Lapham joins me to discuss the draft, free agency, NFL teams and salary cap hell, the possibility of a Bengals Ring of Honor at Paul Brown Stadium, and much, much more. The Bengals Booth Podcast is presented by Bud Light Seltzer. Refresh the game. And here's a quick reminder that you can have the latest edition of this podcast delivered right to your phone, tablet, or computer by subscribing on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or Podbean. It's the greatest thing since starting the seniors. This week was the final week of the regular season for many college basketball teams, meaning it was senior day all over the country, the final home game of the year where teams honor their seniors. Many coaches take it a step further by starting all of their seniors, including the walk-ons. Florida State did that this week, and the walk-ons included Jason Lindner, whose dad was one of my high school teammates. Jason scored an early basket in a lopsided Seminoles win. Of course, when you start the reserves, you run the risk of getting off to a slow start, and that happened to UC last weekend when Coach Brannon started two walk-ons against Memphis, quickly fell behind 6-0, and wound up losing by 6 points. But in my opinion, it was still the right thing to do. Walk-ons bust their tail at practice and help teams get better despite rarely getting the opportunity to play. For me, starting the seniors at their final home game, despite their skill level, is one of the great traditions in college basketball. Now, let's get to football. Much like the bat signal, I shined the lap signal into the nighttime sky this week. In other words, I asked if you had any questions for Dave Lapham on Twitter, and you had a bunch, mostly about the draft and free agency. But I started our conversation with the topic of NFL quarterbacks asserting their power. Lap, let's start with some recent NFL developments. Deshaun Watson wants out in Houston. Russell Wilson hasn't gone quite that far, but he has named the four teams he would be willing to go to if Seattle wanted to make a deal: the Cowboys, Saints, Bears, and Raiders. Here's my question. Is this the start of a movement where superstar quarterbacks call the shots?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, Dan. I mean, it's like when I start hearing what's going on and seeing what's going on, it's like, man, back in the day, guys wouldn't even ever thought about that. But it's all about money and money's power. And I mean, back, you know, when I was playing, coaches made more money than players. Today, not really the case. You know, I mean, the players are making a ton of money, and quarterbacks in particular. So it's almost like so foreign to me when I hear guys saying, oh, he should have a say in who they hire and how they put things together. I mean, not a game plan. Yeah, I understand that. But I mean, you want to be a GM and a quarterback? You want to be a director of football operations and a quarterback? I don't know. It's almost gotten to the point where, you know, there's a power shift going on. I just wonder how far that power shift will go. And it's becoming more and more like, you know, the NBA. I mean, the NBA players can dictate, I want this guy, I want that guy to come with me, and we'll make a big three, and we're going to try to win a world championship. And quarterback's obviously the most important position in football, and maybe the most important position overall in all of team sports. So they've got the power, and they're being compensated that way now. So it's not a surprise, I guess.
Do you expect Watson to get traded, Wilson to get traded, both or neither?
I don't think Wilson will get traded this year. But, you know, obviously if there's enough noise being made, obviously it depends on what happens this year. Depends on what kind of changes are made within the Seattle organization that might pacify Wilson. Obviously he's tired of getting hit. He's been sacked a bunch. I mean, he gets hit and sacked more than any quarterback in the league over the last 9 years. It's crazy. You don't realize it. You know, a lot of it is he holds on to the football and tries to create and extend, and he'll make great plays doing that, but he's also going to take some licks. And when you're out there on your own doing that kind of thing, as an offensive lineman, I mean, your instruction on a, if it's a pocket pass in particular, you know, you're instructed to perform this technique and these mechanics to protect the quarterback in that spot. And if he's elsewhere, he's kind of on his own, and it kind of destroys all of that. So, you know, there's how much of that is a factor in all the punishment that he's taken. So, I mean, maybe he wants to change the schematic of the offense as well as control personnel. I mean, he wants to be offensive coordinator, director of football operations, head scout. He wants to be everything, I guess. So to me, you know, it's, if you can't, everything's built on relationships and trust in really life, never mind sports, but sports, if you can't trust your organization is going to do everything they possibly can to, you know, put you in position to win, maybe you try to find a way to get away from that organization. And I guess that's what it's boiling down to. Guys just don't have the faith and the trust in their organizations that they're going to do, you know, what they need to do. They're certainly paying them. I mean, they're saying, no, we value you, and here's how we value you. When you go to the bank, you're going to see how we value you. But, you know, in these players' opinions, there's more to it than that. And that's what everybody's, you know, really concerned with, I guess, at this point in time. They want everything to be perfect, that's for sure. Everybody's striving to be in the perfect perfect spot, perfect situation to maximize their effort as much as possible, because it's a short career. It can be a very short career.
And that gets interesting where Joe Burrow is concerned, because even before he was drafted, people speculated how happy he was going to be in Cincinnati. And I used to scoff at people who worried about Joe signing a second contract with the Bengals before he had even played in a single game in a Bengals uniform. And I'm still not overly concerned about those kinds of things, but I guess you do have to show a player of his skill level and potential stardom that you are doing everything you can to win.
Yeah, I think so, you know, and really, you know, what they're talking about now, the Jets trying to decide, you know, do we stay with our guy that we picked third, you know, in the draft when he came out of USC, or do we go for one of these, you know, young quarterbacks, Wilson, whoever it is, at number two this year, and start the clock again on that multiple year rookie contract where we can build our organization up and have a window to try to go and win big. You know, it's almost like a double-edged sword, though, because, you know, a lot of times, I mean, some quarterbacks, a lot of them fail. Let's face it. I mean, over 50% of the first-round quarterbacks fail. They don't end up having the career that you would expect. Even the first pick of the draft. I mean, there's no guarantee. Over 50% of them don't even sign a second contract with the team that drafted them. These high first round draft picks, you know, that's just the way it is in the National Football League. It's a total crapshoot. If we're a pure science, the draft wouldn't be as interesting as it is, because it's a total crapshoot. There's no two ways about it. But if you're going to try to go for the gusto with a young quarterback, man, years 1, 2, and 3 may not be the premier years for the guy. It may take him a little bit of time to adjust if he does adjust at all. So you're looking for the perfect storm. You're looking to draft a guy that you've got, you're totally convinced that this is a guy that I can plug and play, and he's going to be able to win for us if we have the right people around him, and then have the money because of his low contract, inexpensive contract, to go and surround himself with all these weapons to go ahead and win. That's the perfect storm. I mean, that just you know, Vegas will take odds on that every single day. But, you know, you look at a guy like Joe Burrow. I think Joe Burrow, when you look at all the components, not just the physical aspect of it, the mental aspect, the intangibles, all the things that go with it, he is a guy, I think, that if you can surround him with some good components, I think he can win for you pretty damn early. I mean, I think he's that type of player. I think he's that type of football intellect. You know, that type of intangibles. I really do. I think he's one of those guys that you can put some money on in that regard.
So yesterday, Ben Roethlisberger agreed to a new contract with the Steelers to save them some salary cap space. In terms of their ability right now, not 2 or 3 years from now, 4 or 5 years from now, how do you rank the quarterbacks in the AFC North? Lamar Jackson, Baker Mayfield, Joe Burrow, Ben Roethlisberger.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix because Lamar Jackson is so different with his skill set. You know, it's hard to rate him. You know, he's like, here's the traditional quarterback, and then here's these hybrids. You know, these different kind of quarterbacks, and he is. Let's put it this way, from a football player standpoint, scares you to death. You know, he's one of those kind of guys that athletically, he is so off the charts. It's unbelievable. Baker Mayfield, I think, you know, once he got the right head coach and offensive system, I think he's shown that he can do the things that he did, you know, at Oklahoma, maybe not to the level at Oklahoma because the competition level is so much more difficult to compete against. But, you know, I think he is on the rise. I think he's an ascending player. I don't think he's a player that's hit his plateau or is on the decline. I think Ben obviously is on the physical decline. There's no question about it. But Ben's the uber competitor. There's no doubt about that. And all the naysayers that he's hearing in this offseason, I think the guy's going to be big time motivated. But honestly, Dan, I think Pouncey retires. The offensive line's kind of in shambles. Foster retired. Pouncey retired. They're just not what they were. I mean, when's the last time we saw the Pittsburgh Steelers unable to run the football to the extent they were unable to run it last year? Unbelievable. And if they don't get those things fixed, you know, I think Ben's at a stage in his career where he can't just put the whole team on his shoulders like he's done in the past and say, I'm going to take you to the promised land. So they're going to be interesting. I think it's a time where you can maybe ease your way past Pittsburgh in terms of what's going on with that organization a little bit. But I put Joe right up there with the other three. The three quarterbacks, the three younger quarterbacks in the division have all won the Heisman. They've won it in different ways for different reasons, but they're all, you know, very capable of transposing those talents that they had in college in the NFL if they have the right people in terms of coaching and scheme and all that sort of thing. So I would rate, they're so young. And again, Jackson, he's so hard to pigeonhole in terms of the traditional quarterback grade, but he scares me to death. He probably scares me as much or more than any of them. And obviously the way he's played against the Bengals, I mean, he's got the Bengals number right now. They haven't come close to finding a way to solve him, really. The one time he played when he was a little bit nicked up, it was a little bit different dynamic. But when he's 100% physically capable of running around like he does, like a human joystick, he's ridiculous. But I honestly, as a player, as a former player, I kind of like Joe Burrow as a total entity at the quarterback position more than Baker. Because I don't think Joe's as mercurial or as, you know, up and down personality standpoint. I think he's more steady, you know, a guy that I think you can count on to not lose his mind and crucial situations and things like that. So I think his makeup gives me a tiebreaker vote over Baker Mayfield. I like Baker Mayfield's skill set, but I think he's sometimes a little bit of a wild card, you know, and I don't see any of that kind of thing in Joe Burrow.
Long-term, I'd take Burrow over any of them. Right now, hard to go against Lamar Jackson. I mean, right now for his ability and the way the Ravens are using him. I guess because of the injury, I'd have to go Baker 2, Burrow 3 right now. But it's amazing that I put Ben 4th. He's the one that's going to the Hall of Fame. He's the one that's got a couple of Super Bowl titles. He's the one that led the Steelers last year to the greatest start in franchise history, and they won the division. And yet, I think the two of us and a lot of people out there are kind of looking at the Steelers as the team that's dropping when they were the team that was the best in the division last year, at least until the playoffs rolled around.
It is crazy. And, you know, people, you'll hear people say a lot that sometimes the end comes, you fall off a cliff. sometimes the end comes, it's a more gradual decline. But one thing that everybody knows, other than Tom Brady, Father Time's undefeated, you know, and Father Time looks like he's catching up to Ben a little bit. Like I said, with Tom Brady, he's, that guy's the biggest freakazoid ever. I mean, he's a trend breaker in every sense of the word.
So the roster cuts have started around the NFL. There will be many more to come. The Vikings cut Kyle Rudolph this week after 10 great years at tight end. Giants have cut Golden Tate. Tyler Eifert got let go by the Jaguars. Sounds like the Raiders are going to cut offensive lineman Gabe Jackson. But like I said, there will be many others. Let's start with Kyle Rudolph, since there's the local tie. Any interest in Kyle Rudolph?
You know, it would have to be at what price, I think, you know, with 10 years in the league. Obviously, is he what he was, you know, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever? Obviously, there's a salary cap casualty, but you're right, Dan. I mean, the interesting thing is there's going to be a lot of situations where guys are out there like, I never expected that. Well, for a lot of reasons, it's going to be the way it is. Instead of $198 million, the cap's going to be $180 or $185. And you have teams, half a dozen teams that are in salary cap jail right now. And now when the salary cap comes out at a lot less, there's going to be maybe 8 teams that'll be in salary cap jail, and they're going to have to start. It's going to be a bloodbath. They're going to have to start whacking people, slicing and dicing. So there's going to be veteran players out there that you're going to be able to get at a discounted price. And there's going to be, out of the 32 teams, maybe as many as 8 that can't even bid. So you're down to 24 bidders instead of 32. So now it's like, man, you've bettered your odds by 25% of being able to land a tier one or a tier two guy. This year, I think tier one and tier two, they're both going to be a little bit higher. You know, some of the high tier twos would be tier one guys in other years, but because of the salary cap situation, the salary cap trouble a lot of teams find themselves in, you're going to have really good players that are making a ton of money that'll be out there that won't be making that money anymore. And can you land some of them? It's going to be interesting to see exactly who's out there. And in the Bengals having the 6th most money to spend in the league tells you that, you know, hopefully they'll be able to land a good tier one player, maybe a couple of tier two guys potentially. So I think that they may find themselves in a pretty good situation. And you look at last year's draft, rated the best in terms of what they got from a production standpoint out of the 7 draft picks they obtained. They got them all high every round, obviously. It was you would hope that they put the bat on the ball on almost every draft pick, and they did. So they have that to build on. And year one to year two is usually the biggest improvement in terms of the light going on and your development. I can attest to that. I remember it being that way. It's like, oh yeah, the game's a lot different in year two here than it was my rookie year. So you have that, and you know, first, second, and third year players for the Bengals, they have another good draft. I mean, they could find themselves in a pretty good spot if they can pick up a couple of tier two and one of those tier one free agents to go in that mix. It's going to be interesting. See what you get there in free agency, then attack it in the draft. And they have money to spend in free agency. They have the 5th pick in every round in the draft. I mean, they should be able to do some damage here in this offseason, Dan, for sure.
You can make the case that with the salary cap going down, there has never been a better year to be where the Bengals are in the top 6 in cap room right now.
I agree. There's no question about it. I mean, you know, when you can, you don't want to say, oh yeah, there'll be another world pandemic, you know, like we just experienced in 2020. I mean, the odds of taking place what took place and, you know, disturbing and disrupting every single professional sport, and then disrupting their revenue in every single professional sport. You're right. I mean, the Bengals have found themselves in a pretty good situation. The fact that they are very salary cap savvy, you know, and some people criticize the way they handle the cap, but around the league, you know, when you talk to people around the league, Dan, and we both have, Katie Blackburn gets very high grades for her acumen in terms of handling cap. You know, a lot of people are like, wow, she knows what she's doing. And she has put them in a pretty good position, you know, to to take advantage of it. And now it's instead of your normal free agency, it's going to be a gold standard free agency. It's going to be a spit shine free agency. There's going to be a lot of talent out there that you would have never, ever thought might be available. You're going to be able to take a shot at.
And the Bengals are creating more cap space as we speak. On Friday, they cut offensive lineman B.J. Finney. That saves $3.25 million against the cap. Here are some of the other guys that are rumored to possibly be in danger of being cut for cap space. Geno Atkins is obviously the biggest one. That would save $9.5 million. Bobby Hart would save $5.9 million. C.J. Uzomah, a possibility, could save $5 million. Giovanni Bernard, a possibility, could save $4.1 million. Xavier Suafilo's name has been mentioned, $2.4 million. Which of those guys do you think is most likely to be let go?
I think that, you know, obviously AJ won't be coming back, but there's no cap ramification, you know, there as far as that contract is concerned. But I would probably think Geno Atkins is one where, you know, the most savings can be made. And you would think, just like a lot of teams around the league, some of these players that are being cut, you know, teams are going to let these players go as salary cap casualties and say, wink, wink, look, we're not waiving you because we don't want you anymore. We don't think you're capable of playing good enough football for us and being a factor, but we can't afford you in this situation, period. So we may be getting back to you. And, you know, Bengals may say that kind of thing to Geno, depending on who has an interest out there in terms of other teams. But, yeah, I mean, I think he will be – he's where they can make the most savings, and that seems to be where I think the salary cap axe is going to fall first.
I mean, if you let Geno and Bobby Hart go, just those two, you can bring Carl Lawson back.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could use that to franchise tag Carl Lawson if you wanted to.
Absolutely. And then, and you wouldn't have even dipped into the money that you're looking to go out and get other free agents. Yeah. If you just do some house cleaning within your own organization, who are you trying to resign? Who can you let go to try to get that whole thing, you know, structured properly, just some internal shifting before you even go out there and address outside free agents. Yeah, you're right. I mean, they could really, I mean, it would be, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a Hollywood star that had a facelift that looked so dramatically different after had the facelift done, but it could be one of the most unbelievable facelifts ever in the history of mankind that Bengals could pull off this year and changing the entire look of their franchise. You really could.
I could name some that went badly. I won't.
I hear.
But there have definitely been some that didn't work out so well. I want to change the subject briefly, and then we'll get back to the draft and free agency, because we have a lot of questions about that were submitted by fans with the hashtag AskLap on Twitter. But here's the question I want to get to before that. Recently, we saw photographs and video where it appeared the Bengals were looking at different letter sizes and colors for a possible Ring of Honor at Paul Brown Stadium. There has been no official announcement yet, but it certainly looks like they are seriously considering it. What did you think when you heard that and saw that?
Yeah, I think that there'd be, I guess everybody's reaction would be it's about time. You know, I mean, I think it is definitely time for something like that. I can understand, you know, Mike Brown, in conversations over the years that I've had with Mike Brown, honestly, his big thing is, he really does not want a single players out. You know, it's like he has an appreciation for what so many players have done for him over the years from a contribution, you know, to the franchise standpoint, that he just feels like singling them out. And people are going to say, that's just an excuse. He doesn't want to spend the money, take the time, you know, whatever the reasons. But, you know, I honestly believe that's kind of, knowing Mike, you know, for a few years now, I think really believe that's his mindset. So I'm not sure that the Katie and Troy and Elizabeth and everybody else shares the same opinion, but I do know that over the years Mike has felt that way. So if Elizabeth and Katie and Troy, if they can sell it to Mike and get it done, I'd welcome it with open arms. I mean, I think, you know, you think about guys like Ken Riley, would have been great if Ken Riley could have been in that Ring of Honor before he passed away. Now it's going to have to be posthumously. So, you know, it's that, that's, you know, you, those kind of things start coming to mind right away. But yeah, I just think that there's nothing wrong with showing an appreciation for the history of the franchise, given the fan base a rallying point. I see positives in all of that.
My impression from interacting with Mike over the years on this subject was that his feeling was football is the ultimate team game. Right. The right guard has just as much of an impact on your success as the star player whose name would go up on the Ring of Honor. But what I think might get mistaken in Mike's thought process on that is that the right guard would appreciate seeing the quarterback's name go up there, even if, you know, that player had just as big a role on leading the team to a great season.
I agree with you, Dan. I mean, it was, you know, when Kenny Anderson won a passing title, I know that as a lineman, I lived vicariously through the success of Kenny Anderson. Feel like, oh man, you know, I had a little bit of a part in him having that tremendous success. He did it. His abilities, he executed it. But, you know, everybody had to do their job in order for Kenny Anderson to do his job to the level that he did his job to win a passing title. And he won four of them. He won four passing titles. And as a lineman, you know, that was involved with that, you know, you think, must have done something right some of the time, you know, and you do, you start to live vicariously through the success of others. And that's what teamwork is, really. You know, everybody feeds off each other, and you, you know, somebody's always going to get more credit than others. That's just the nature of the beast. But, you know, if you're not doing your job, you're going to make it more difficult for everybody else to achieve the success that they could have. So everybody's important. And I agree with you. I do think that that's Mike's mindset, that's his philosophy. He doesn't really want to single people out because, you know, you have 11 moving parts on offense and defense. You have a lot of things going on out there in the football field on an every snap basis, there's no doubt.
All right, let's get to Ask Lap questions. We've got a bunch. We've got some good ones, many of them dealing with the draft and free agency, as you would expect. Let's start with Vincent. Here is his question in Ask Lap. What would you address in the draft on defense? Something specific or best player available?
Well, I mean, to me, I guess you'd hope that they'd be one and the same, that the best player available would address a need. And I'm one that would go if it's one of my top needs, if it's a top two or three need overall, I'd go with the player that fits that the best. I would not reach to address a need. In other words, I would take the best player that I have a need. Like, I'm not going to take a quarterback. If the best player available on the board is I'm not taking a quarterback, obviously. We just took one, the number one pick last year. So, you know, you just don't go with best player available unilaterally across the board. But if the best player available is an offensive tackle, I go there. Best player available is a defensive, a pass rusher that would scare people, you know, I go there. So I think that in my mind, it would be a combination. And I proceed from there. I guess the other thing that I would do if I was ever running a draft is, you know, try to find the best way that you possibly can, because you never know how the order is going to go. That's why the sooner in the draft you pick, the less variables you have, so you know what kind of player pool there's going to be. But even projecting down to the second round, or the third round, even if you have one of the higher picks, you don't exactly know who's going to go where and when and what trades are going to happen and all those sort of things in the first round. But the best of my ability, though, I would say, all right, well, the strengths of the draft are these positions. These teams are going to make a run. Just try to piece the puzzle together and say, all right, well, the best player available, there might be at that position, there may be a guy in the second round that's pretty close, but the best player available at this position is so far ahead of the next guy that might be available in the second or third round. That's my tiebreaker. You know, I take the big picture view of it as well. I just wouldn't pigeonhole and focus on just that one pick. You know, I want to try to, you know, strike as consistently as I can on a round by round basis of the best player available fitting needs, you know, to a larger degree as I possibly could.
And when it comes to defense, where the draft is concerned, I think you can probably eliminate a couple of spots with a high pick. You don't need a safety, at least high. I wouldn't be shocked if you take one at some point, if you really like one, but you don't have to worry about Bates and Bell in the short term. Probably don't need a linebacker high with the three that you drafted last year. Although again, at some point, I wouldn't be shocked to see them take another. So as opposed to drafting for need, it's almost eliminating the areas where you're already strong.
Right. Like, you know, I wouldn't necessarily put running back up there. As you know, quarterback, obviously, running back on the offensive side of it, defensive, like you said, safety, and particularly inside backer, outside backer. If he's that dominant rush guy, though, if he's that edge guy, you know, it's, now you get that hybrid. Is it a defensive end? Is it an outside linebacker? What is it? All I know is he gets after the quarterback. You know, I may go after that guy. I agree, Dan. I'm in the same thought process.
Next question comes from Sam. If the offensive line improved substantially in free agency, do the Bengals still take Penei Sewell if available, or opt for a wide receiver or tight end Kyle Pitts?
Yeah, or and the thing is, unfortunately, this year, from an edge rush standpoint, there's no Myles Garrett, there's no Chase Young, there's nobody like that. So, you know, the edge rush guy, I think the Bengals are going to be able to get a good edge rush guy in the second round. I think University of Miami has two. University of Pittsburgh has two. I mean, there's some edge rush guys. So they're all not going to go in the first round. I think somebody may be there in the early stages of that second round. That's exactly right. If you go out and you get a tier one offensive tackle and a tier two guard, now all of a sudden in the draft, does that change your focus? Does that change your thought process? It could, depending on who you get. And, it absolutely could. All I know is, from the offensive line standpoint, having played the position, when we had our best offensive lines in the 80s, Anthony Munoz was the eraser at left tackle. Penei Sewell can be an eraser at left tackle, from what I've seen. And we had a butt-kicking guard in Max Montoya, who would just as soon beat the heck out of you than look at you. And I think that, you know, they could go out and get – if you could get somebody, one of those guards, you know, in free agency, you get Tooney or Scherf in free agency and get – if not Sewell – if you don't get a tackled in free agency and you could get Sewell, if you could have those two areas filled in, I just know that works. I've seen that work. You know, with Anthony Munoz, we said, we don't have to slide. Let's everybody else take care of people in here. He's got him. He's the eraser. He's taking care of that guy. Those kind of players or generational players are like a once, you know, just a dream come true for any offensive line coach. And that's why I value Sewell. But again, if they sign the best tackle in free agency, and Sewell could go before number five anyway, in my opinion, it could happen. Heck, I saw Todd McShay's latest mock draft. He's got four quarterbacks going the first four picks of the draft by a trade with trade and all those other things. But if Sewell is gone, I wouldn't have a problem then going with the best wide receiver. I wouldn't have a problem doing that. The tight end, I know everybody loves this tight end, and I can understand why, because he is a mismatched nightmare, Dan. The guy's 6'5", 250, and runs in the high 4.4s. That's what they think he's going to run. But I'm not even sure he's an adequate blocker. Watching him, he's willing, but not capable. They play him. They put him out there as a wide receiver. They play him in the slot. He's a big mismatch problem is what he is, throwing the football. And there's no doubt that that he's a talented player. Absolutely no question about it. I mean, the guy is a freak. And you but basically in football, you're trying to create and then have the defense counter your creation. And this guy would be a point of emphasis in that regard. You'd have to respond to what the offense is dictating, and the defense is trying to counter when you have a guy like this tight end, Pitts, there's no doubt. But if we're going to do something to receiver, I'd go Chase. The dude had 1,800 yards and 20 touchdowns. Who's throwing him the football? Joe Burrow. I mean, I think he's the best receiver. Watching him, man, he's strong. He throws people around, releasing off the line of scrimmage. You know, he's not the most physically imposing. He's not the fastest of all the receivers. But what he is a damn good football player. So, yeah, I mean, if I get my offensive line taken care of in the draft, I wouldn't have any trouble saying let's evaluate weapons for Joe Burrow on the, at the quarterback position. I don't think there's an edge rusher that I'd take it at five necessarily. So I wouldn't have a problem doing that.
Question from Alan. Is Zach Taylor on the hot seat if he wins fewer than 8 games this year?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm sure he's on his own hot seat. You know, you'd like to see the doubling down continue. 1-2 in the first year, double the win total of 4. You want to at least double it in year 3 to 8. So you're at the over and under, I guess. I think rather than just putting a number of wins out there, because you never know the reason for the wins and losses. Like we talked about Pittsburgh starting out 11-0. Then all of a sudden they had some significant defensive injuries, you know, and you can never forecast the injuries that might take place during the course of the season. And they can cripple a football team, particularly injuries to the wrong people. So I'm not going to say unilaterally, no matter what, Zach has to win more than 8 football games, because you don't know what's going to transpire during the course of that season. But if he leaves training camp with the team that is going to be hopefully so much different than last year's team that won 4 games in terms of what they're going to be able to get in free agency in another draft and develop last year's draft class, I mean, everybody would hope that you're going to win at least 8, maybe more, but you don't know how the season's going to unfold in terms of injury and other things that may be involved.
You'll also have 1 extra game, it would appear. Yep. It looks like the NFL's on the verge of going to 17, and it would be a home game against the 49ers for Cincinnati, which would be interesting. Next question comes from Ryan. If Penei Sewell and Ja'Marr Chase are both gone at number 5, what should the Bengals do? And he goes on to say, I think trading back would be ideal, but if they don't, who should they take?
Yeah, that's the first thing that came to my mind. Trade back, you know, as well. That's a good one. If they're both there at 5 and they can't find a trade partner, and Chase is gone, and I mean, obviously everybody's saying it's like, well, if you don't take Pitts, you know, it's ridiculous. Pitts is showing up in every mock draft I see now. He's not going any lower than 7. You know, I mean, he's up there. There's no doubt. And I do agree that he's a talent that people have to, he's a matchup problem. And what you're trying to cause every game in the National Football League is matchup problems. And it's hard for a coach to do it by scheme. You know, I'm going to scheme guys open all the time. Shanahan has got a reputation, and deservedly so, for scheming guys open as well as any coach in the National Football League. But that's hard to do on a snap-by-snap basis. You know, as we've seen, Dan, windows are tight in the NFL. That's the biggest adjustment for college quarterbacks. You know, a guy's a yard open in college, you don't throw that. In the NFL, that's as good as it gets. You got to fire that sucker in there. So, you know, when you have a mismatch guy, you know, like Pitts, that's something to take into consideration. You know, the Bengals, though, Dan, over the years, they value corners as well. They've taken cornerbacks in the first and second round. You know, they may be the one to take a cornerback with that fifth pick in the draft. if they don't like any of the other receivers, or they may have the cornerback rated higher than they have Pitts or you know, whoever else that's left at number five when they do their board, when they evaluate their board.
I think there's one other thing to keep in mind where Kyle Pitts is concerned. I think people might be underestimating how the Bengals feel or felt about CJ Uzama working with Joe Burrow. He was off to a great start last year, 2 games, 8 catches, 87 yards and a touchdown. Now, admittedly, that's a small sample size, but that projects to 64 catches for 696 yards in a season. And he tore his Achilles. So, you know, there's definitely a red flag there in terms of coming back, but I really think they expected that combination to produce big things.
And I think that I'd feel very safe in saying I have not studied Pitts that much in terms of blocking. I've seen he's a contested catch fool. I mean, he's a great player. He is an offensive force. There's no question, but I would stake my reputation that probably at this point, CJ Uzama is a more capable blocker, you know, than Pitts is as well. And that's a factor, you know, when you get to this league. I do know one thing. Pitts is not Kittle. He's not going to block like George Kittle. I mean, he's not that type of guy. I think, and he doesn't block as well as Kelce. I think, you know, that's an underrated part of Kelce's game. I hear all these comparisons to Kelce. I don't think he blocks like Kelce. Kelce will block for you, man. He really will.
Next question comes from Jim. Is there an offensive lineman in free agency that the Bengals could sign that would be better than drafting Sewell? Or is Sewell a lock if available at number five?
Well, I think if you have a chance to sign like a, I know Trent Williams is on the back nine. He's 32 years old, but the dude is a player. Pro Football Focus rated him the number one. He was the highest rated offensive tackle in football. I mean, if you can get a proven commodity like that to line up at left tackle, he'd be able to play. You know, he's not done. He's on the back nine for sure, but he's not done, obviously. And whenever you're taking somebody from the college level to the national football level, there's always a question about that transition. And, you know, the knock on Sewell is Oregon's the finesse offense. And, you know, it's not NFL type stuff all the way. And from top to bottom in terms of what they asked him to do. So in my mind, if you've got a proven commodity, and, you know, or even if you could sign a gun, well, it would have to be a tackle, obviously, for them not to draft Sewell, in my opinion. But it'd be a guy like that. Darrell Williams had a great year with the Buffalo Bills. I mean, if I were able to sign Darrell Williams, even one of the Williams, I'd be fine with. If they could sign him, I'd be okay with him. And he's a little bit younger, too. I believe he's like 28, 29 years old.
Yeah, he's 28.
Yep. And so, yeah, I mean.
Taylor Moten's the other one, right?
Yeah, Moten would be the other one. But at my level, I guess from the Williams brothers standpoint, my Trent Williams would be level one guy. Darrell Williams would be a upper level two guy. You know, for me, I don't think Darrell Williams would cost as much as Trent Williams. And maybe you could, you know, get a little more bang for your buck with Darrell Williams because you'd be able to go out and get somebody else as well. But if you're trying to solve your biggest need, man, go out and get Trent Williams, man. And if they can get him, somehow you can get that done.
All right. Next question comes from Tyler. Here's what he writes. It goes Jamar Chase, Kyle Pitts, and Penei Sewell in that order. Tell me why I'm wrong. Well, if Tyler's going by alphabetical order, he's right. It would be Chase, Pitts, Sewell in that order, but he's obviously not intending it to be alphabetical. So tell Tyler, is he wrong? Chase, Pitts, Sewell in that order.
Well, you know, to me, Tyler, Chase and Pitts are great players, but if Joe Burrow doesn't have time to get the ball to Chase and Pitts, it's a moot point. You know, that's why, you know, to me, all we've talked about is the number one priority is protecting Joe Burrow. It was tragic how Joe Burrow threw the ball so much last year and took a beating. So the best way to solve that problem on Joe Burrow coming back from an ACL injury is to make sure that he's got people up front that are going to do a hell of a job protecting him, give him that much more time and ability to operate, and let those skilled people operate down the football field. I mean, a lot of these, all these guys were on good college football teams who had good offensive lines and good quarterbacks that could get them the football. So they may come into the NFL and it's like, oh, it doesn't even look like the same guy. Well, it doesn't, because the offensive line's, you know, getting taken advantage of more than the offensive line that he played with in college, and the quarterback's not having time to operate. I mean, that's why, like we were talking about before, Mike Brown, it's the ultimate team game. It is. I mean, and first and foremost, you know, you do have to have an offensive line that is going to give Joe Burrow time and confidence. I think confidence is going to be a big thing. I think Joe Burrow is a very confident guy, but man, after going through what he went through, the traumatic hit in every sense of the word that he took, and the traumatic injury that resulted from it, you gotta help him. You gotta make him right away feel as comfortable as he did before the injury in that pocket. And the best way to do it is to get big beasts up front.
Question from Drew: are there any under the radar offensive line prospects or free agents that we should keep an eye on?
Under the radar. I haven't really studied it, the draft that far. I don't know how far under the radar that you're that you might be talking about, but I think the guy that I would, maybe the level two guy that may not get as much interest, or he might, because he's a level two guy that is versatile, is Feeler from Pittsburgh. I think Matt Feeler would be somebody that Frank Pollock would do a good job with. I really do. I think that could potentially be, you know, somebody that they might be able to target a little bit.
Tackle or a guard, because he's played both. What do you like him at?
Yeah, I would see him. I would try him at both and see where he fit in terms of working with other guys. You know, I'm going to get my best five guys out there no matter what the situation is. And if he ends up being, you know, in that mix at tackle, so be it. If he's in that mix at guard, so be it. I mean, there are a lot of people, you know, that are really good linemen. Jackson Carmen, the kid from Clemson. I mean, he's not under the radar, but
Fairfield High School.
Yep. I wouldn't mind having a local boy. I wouldn't mind having that big old man in the offensive line. I mean, I don't know if the under the radar is meaning, you know, the guys they're talking about for top five picks, or guys that are later in the draft. I'm not sure, but I haven't really studied, you know, all of those guys that are going to be later in the draft at this point.
Question from Coach K All Day. I don't think this is Mike Krzyzewski. Who could be some potential replacements in free agency if Will Jackson leaves? Well, let's start with the notion of Will Jackson leaving. Do you think they'll re-sign him or tag him?
I think they have the money to re-sign Lawson and Will. I really do. And I'd make every effort to do that. I think, you know, Carl Lawson obviously is still an ascending player, 25 years old. You know, he's obviously got power. He's sudden. He's got that really unusual first step quickness, explosiveness. He doesn't have length. That's the only thing about Carl Lawson to me that, you know, is the one trait that you'd like to see that he doesn't have is length. But he's got everything else. And then obviously, I mean, Will Jackson is, when you look at the top 50 players, both of those guys show up in the top 15, you know, on a league-wide basis. So if that's what, you know, all the evaluators are thinking, you know, why not make sure you get your own re-signed? You know, if you got a couple of top 15 free agents out there, and you know what their strengths and weaknesses are, and you know what you need to work with them to improve upon. And so I try to get them both signed. So that would be, you know, that would be my first answer, obviously, would be, you know, I wouldn't necessarily let him take a walk. I'd try to get him under contract.
I think getting back to what we were talking about earlier with Geno and Bobby Hart, if they were to make those moves to create more space, I think they would have room for Lawson Jackson, yep, and an offensive lineman.
Yep. I agree.
If they created more space.
I agree.
Next question comes from Mon. This is an interesting one. There's been speculation that Kevin Zeitler could be available. That would mean he was getting cut by the Giants. Would the Bengals consider bringing him back?
I would think that from an organizational standpoint, they would consider it, but it'd be at the right price. Again, Kevin Zeitler would be out there because he'd be a cap casualty, but he's still operating at an efficient level, but not at the dollars that he's, you know, he'd be currently making. Would he come back to Cincinnati for a haircut? I don't know. I mean, I think that both all parties parted ways on good terms. I don't think there was any bitterness. I think that Kevin Zeitler felt like he was treated well when he was here with the Cincinnati Bengals, being a first round pick out of Wisconsin. And I think they liked his work ethic. They liked everything about Kevin Zeitler. They had no problems with him whatsoever. Good locker room guy. Everything was positive about Kevin Zeitler. So I don't think there'd be any hesitation on their end. Now, as far as Kevin Zeitler's concerned, I don't remember Kevin Zeitler voicing. He was not a very, you know, somebody that would tell you things were bothering him. He wasn't that type of player. But I think that he was pretty satisfied with the Bengals from an organizational standpoint. To me, that's not a thing that's beyond the realm of possibility whatsoever.
I think they were a playoff team every year he was here.
Yeah. He was here during the height of the Marvin Lewis era. There's no doubt. And he was a really good player. I mean, he's just a solid player. There's no question. He's made a lot of money. So the decision would be, if you're going to play for less money, would you come back to Cincinnati or would you go elsewhere to play for less money? If it's a team that's closer to the playoffs in his estimation, that does need an interior offensive lineman, he might choose that over the Cincinnati Bengals.
Can you give me your impression of him breathing after things did not go well on a particular play?
Man, he was Sheen. He was a deep breather, man.
All right. Final Ask Lap question this week comes from Dalton, who does an incredible job of posting Bengals graphics on Twitter. Here's his question. He would love to hear if you have any stories about Jim LeClair.
Boy, Jim LeClair was a guy I played with for a long time. We were teammates with the Bengals, then teammates with the Generals. Both went to New Jersey at the same time and played a couple of years there. And Jim LeClair, I can tell you a personal story. My rookie year, we're doing interior line drills, and it's interior running game. So there's really no secret as to what's happening. I mean, all it is like a nutcracker drill that's expanded to – like about to entail, you know, six players, three on offense, three on defense, a couple of guards in the center, two defensive tackles and an inside linebacker. So we're running the drill and one play called for a double team on the defensive tackle. And I was supposed to rub off to Jim LeClair to the next level, get up to that next level on the double team. We double the defensive tackle. I get a pretty good release and I'm up to the next level. And I start peeking to try to locate Jim LeClair and I mean, I got hit. He put a forearm on my forehead, man. And I had the yellow flash. And, the birds were circling. And it was a long distance phone call ringing. Nobody was picking up on the other end. And, man, I was literally wrung. And I thought, wow. I mean, Jim LeClair had an unbelievable forearm. So I come back to the huddle. And Stan Walters, a fellow Syracuse offensive lineman, he kind of peeks his head into me. He goes, "You okay?" I said, "Yeah, I think so." He goes, "Let me give you a tip, rookie. Don't be peeking when you're looking for Jim LeClair." I said, I found that out on my own, man. That dude, he could come downhill and he'd try to drive your head into your shoulders and, you know, make you no neck. He was something. And another thing I remember doing is going to watch Jim LeClair wrestle Victor, the wrestling bear that would tour the cities. And Jim LeClair was a wrestling champ in college. He was a great wrestler. And this dude had broad shoulders, man, like coat hanger shoulders and, you know, tapered down to no waist. And he was just really strong. And Victor had a muzzle and they declawed him. So he had took his teeth out, put a muzzle on him and declawed him. what is it? It's a big old bear. Well, nobody, you know, pinned Victor. And, but Jim LeClair, he starts like going after Victor like he's wrestling in a college match. He shoots a leg and he tries to take Victor down, you know, and Victor tries to swat. He got Victor on his back. And the guy who handled Victor said it had never happened before. And as soon as he got Victor on his back, the guy like waved it off, ended the match. I mean, in my mind, he pinned Victor, the wrestling bear. I'm like, dude, that's unbelievable. Because Victor was, it was at an outdoor camping show. And they had big swimming pools around the ring. And Victor was backhanding people into the swimming pools, you know. And LeClair goes up there and pins. I couldn't believe it. I'm telling you, Jimmy LeClair. And one other final story on LeClair. This one's not quite as pretty, but this guy cuts him off when he's driving to practice and just, you know, almost causes an accident. So, you know, the guy, LeClair, drives up next to the guy, and the guy's got like two other guys with him in the car, and he signals for LeClair to pull over. So LeClair and this car pull over, and LeClair gets out of the car, and the guy and his two friends get out of the car, and they start getting after LeClair, and he's innocent. And they cut him off, and the one guy takes a swing at him. Jim LeClair, one punches, three guys, three knockouts, out cold. Police come. They're like trying to, you know, what went down here? And Jim says, look, he said, there's one of me, there's three of them. You know, what do you think happened here? And he was late for practice. And when I asked him what happened, he told me, and I'm like, man, those guys, bad decision to challenge Jim LeClair. I'm telling you, that guy, pound for pound, might have been the toughest human being alive.
He shot the leg on Victor the Bear.
Got the leg, man. He's trying to do the takedown. He's throwing moves on him. It's unbelievable. He's doing the escape move. He was wrestling his tail off. It was classic.
Did he ever share how Victor's breath was?
He did. In fact, Dan, he said the worst part of it, Victor could get the tongue out of that mask. Victor's tongue was about 3 feet long.
Oof.
And Victor was wrapping the tongue around LeClair's head. Ugh. You know? And he said, that tongue smelled to the high heavens, boy. It stunk like nothing he'd ever smelled in his life. And Victor was, it was all over Jimmy's head. Yeah, he needed a shower after that match.
Dalton, I bet you're glad you asked for stories about Jim LeClair. That was the perfect capper to this week's or this version of Ask Lap. Partner, thank you so much. Awesome stuff as always. Look forward to doing this again sometime soon.
My pleasure, Dan. Feel the same. Have a good one.
That's going to do it for this episode of the Bengals Booth Podcast, brought to you by Bud Light Seltzer. Refresh the game. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe, and if you have a minute, give it a rating or share a comment. That helps more Bengals fans find this podcast. I'm Dan Hoard, and thank you for listening to the Bengals Booth Podcast.